Hi, I'm Jesse Hirsch. Welcome to the Future Herd. Today's episode is one that I was particularly excited to record. And the irony is that I do these intros after I've done the episode as a kind of overture where I let you know a little bit about the guest, a little bit about the conversation. And this is where I do have to start with a disclaimer. Despite my best attempts, and perhaps as a consequence of Muhammad's encouragement, we did nerd out just a little bit about the potential of AI in agriculture. And this is where I kind of have to take a moment to situate the context that we're currently in a bit of an AI bubble, an AI hype craze that does add a lot of, you know, nonsense, a lot of baloney, a lot of exaggeration. But that's why agriculture is a little different. Because agriculture is the one area where AI really proves its worth. And not just that, but has a potentially exponential and empowering dynamic, provided we're willing to pay attention, provided we're willing to learn and embrace the kind of critical literacies that are necessary to make sure that the tools bend to us instead of us bending to the tools. And that's where Muhammad is an exceptional leader, because he is one of the few people that I've encountered in the agricultural sector who are able to really appreciate the potential of both. You know, on the one hand, the curiosity, the risk, the kind of entrepreneurial nature of being a farmer. But on the flip side, the curiosity, the empowerment, the innovation, the iteration that technology enables. And, you know, this is an example where I think Muhammad is able to not just wear those two hats, but be a translator, help create a culture of innovation around AI, around agriculture, that while there are people doing this across the country, I'm not sure so many have as unique and insightful as a perspective as Muhammad's. So again, normally in our intros, I like to give you a hint of what the subjects are, but this time I'm not. Because this is the second episode in our ongoing series around artificial intelligence, and I really want you to lean in. Because I know that there are people listening to this with a wide range of technological literacy, let alone AI literacy. And I kind of want you to take my hand and to go on a long-term journey where, on the one hand, we go deep, but on the other hand, we maintain your interest, our comprehension, and hopefully coherence. And I kind of feel we did that today with Muhammad. So let's listen in to what was for me a thoroughly enjoyable conversation, which I hope you enjoy even only half as much. Muhammad, welcome to the Future Herd.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Now, I've built a ritual where the first question I throw to every guest is a bit of a Rorschach test. What does the future mean to you?
What does the future mean to me? I like this question. I think the future is technology that is enabling you to really expand whatever your strength is. And I know that sounds really generic, but you know, when I think about a lot of different things in my life, but also just even working with family and whatnot, I just think about, you know, everything we do really well, like how can we make it exponential, basically. So in a really cool way, I think technology is going to help elevate our advantages. But I think at the same time, there's going to be a lot of gaps in it. And I think when the way we're growing tech today, it's growing way too fast, you know, in terms of us being able to regulate it and monitor it in a way that it can grow in a healthy way. So I hope we can balance that approach. I don't think we will, but I think in terms of just the future and where we can go with it, I've never been more excited than I am today.
Right on. And I kind of play this game as interviewer. I'm only allowed to kind of ask questions based on the material that the guests give me. And I do want to come back to the word strength, because I think we should talk about the strength of Canadians, the Canadian agri-food sector. I think that would be a fun thread for us to play. But this is our second episode where I get to talk about AI. And I'm excited about AI. I talk to everyone I can about AI. So I want to start by saying, I do have to resist the urge to nerd out. I hope you will help me with that over the course of today's conversation.
No, I won't help you at all.
Oh, okay, we might be in for trouble. Abandon all hope, ye who enter. And I usually, the second question I throw at a guest is kind of like a lore or an origin question. And in your case, where did your relationship with technology begin? Like, when did you decide that this was an area that not only merited your curiosity, but certainly aligned with your professional path?
You know, can I take this in a really weird way?
Please do.
In a weird direction. Okay. So growing up, I didn't grow up in Canada. I grew up in everywhere but Canada. And for a long time, so I'm Lebanese by heritage. I mean, I'm Lebanese as well right now. And, you know, growing up in Lebanon, the thing that you really get to see compared to Canada is there's so much accessibility in Canada for a lot of different things. Like when it comes to, let's say, electricity, water, like the simple stuff, right? So everything is painful in Lebanon, always trying to access it. And somebody aptly told me once that Lebanon is the future. And Lebanon is the future not because it's going to have the most high-tech stuff, but because of, you know, every issue that any nation feels or suffers. So like the acute effects of climate change, the impact of, you know, mismanaging national finances as we see in the country right now. You're able to see these issues amplified before they're impacting others. And so I can't emphasize climate change enough with this answer. So because we always felt the burden of, you know, geopolitics and a lot of different issues way in the future, or like way before anybody else, let's say the impact of water shortages, or let's say the broken food supply system, you had to rely on technology. And technology is such a democratizing force. And I know that sounds cliche, but if I can be really specific, it's democratizing because it enables you to be able to operate on your own without having to depend on anyone. So I guess my relationship with technology comes from that foundation. It's that you don't have to rely on anybody with that technology. So today, you know, on the farm that my father and I help manage, like we use a lot of different technology features. And we use it for that purpose. It's just, you know, it helps us rely on ourselves as opposed to having to depend on anybody else. So that's, I guess, the foundation story when it comes to my love for technology.
Right on, right on. And your point about democratization, I think, is incredibly relevant when it comes to agriculture and when it comes to the way in which farmers think of their tools and think of their technology. It used to be you could say that technology was democratizing and people would just go, yes. I think right now it is a bit of a contentious statement, social media being exhibit A. But I feel that literacy is a major enabler of that. That if you can enable greater literacy, that's what enables technology to be democratizing. So give me a sense of how you're attempting to do that or accomplishing that in the Canadian agricultural sector. Right? How are you enabling a literacy and a curiosity of technology in a culture, whether farming or not, where I think people are kind of suspicious of technology for a range of different reasons?
Okay, I'm going to give you a super long answer. Buckle in. So so you brought up a really good point about social media. When it comes to social media, I think the foundation of social media was democratizing because it enabled users to operate their social networks in their own way. And the influence of algorithms and other advertorial purposes on these platforms were not there. So they weren't pushing users in a specific direction. They weren't pushing things, content specifically towards them. It was much more user generated or driven. that's the way I would see it. And I think somebody recently asked me that question on another podcast. So I love that you brought that up, because now I can reframe my answer because I've given more thought to it. Moving ahead, though, when it comes to technology in agriculture, I would argue farmers have always been on the cutting edge of technology. Like, think about the different risks that you have to manage on your farm. Like, so I've worked at General Electric. Like, there was this concept called the Brilliant Factory, where you would have a floor, and at the beginning of each day, the teams would be able to decide what they wanted to do that day. It was a very cooperative system, and whatever was decided as the plan of the day, they would execute it. But you're working in an environment where you've eliminated external environmental uncertainties, right? Again, supply chain scenarios, of course, would pop up, but in terms of like what you're actually dealing with, like very much you had a blank canvas where the external environment wasn't impacting you. When it comes to agriculture, think about like the numbers. I mean, just in soil alone, like 2/3 of the world's biodiversity is just in soil alone. So imagine you're dealing with you're growing
and the key 2/3, like the key 2/3. If we right? don't have that biodiversity in soil, the rest of the biodiversity.
Exactly.
I digress,
right?
Please.
Yeah, no, exactly. So like, imagine, I think like we look over that often. So it's like, so you have 2/3 of that biodiversity that you have to contend. But that's it, just in soil alone. Think about the right, like just think your external environment, your ecosystem. Think about, you know, just wind is, for example, as well. What do you spray? How does that all combine together? You're dealing with millions and millions of variables. So when it comes to agriculture, first off, farmers are always taking immense risk year over year. Secondly, when it comes to technology adoption, I would argue they've always been on the cutting edge of adoption. But the issue has been these days, you have a lot of different companies that are emerging, and rightfully emerging so, and you're operating in a more competitive space. So sometimes it might come off as they don't want to test it, but they don't want to test it because you're asking them to risk time on something that is already risky within an industry that is already contending with, again, millions of risks. So you're just adding more risk to them, right?
You know, you take the phrase the bleeding edge, and in agriculture, it really could be a bleeding edge, and that's why that risk is kind of buried in. Please continue.
But this is to your point, right? And I think, yes, exactly about bleeding edge. And I think when you look at like the adoption of technology, if it works, they'll use it. Like the self-propelled combine eliminated 10 jobs. Yes, that's the way to go. I think when it comes to software, we're entering a new age. I was actually telling a few folks on the team this week about what I think the next wave of artificial intelligence, and the way I define it, first of all, AI is advanced statistical pattern recognition. There are multiple tools of accomplishing what this definition of AI is. And it can come through many different forms. But what we're seeing with agentic AI right now, I think we're going to be coming to a paradigm within agriculture where AI can be more easily adopted, because as opposed to 2019, where there wasn't really a lot of data to collect, we're now in a scenario where there's too much. So how can agents connect the dots with the multiple data entries and, again, platforms that farmers are using today to make sense of their operations, and then also highlight different, I guess, next steps for them, right? Because they need a bit of a guardian angel. I think those agents can be those guardian angels. I'm calling it operational persistence, but that's a long-winded answer for you. Hope that.
No, that was a fantastic answer, and it allows me to throw you a big curveball with an anecdote in the middle, a self-serving anecdote, because you said something that is an obsession of mine, which I'll reframe as making the on-ramp to the agricultural sector as easy and accessible as possible. Right? Making it really simple for us to attract not just talented people to the sector, but curious people, right? People who want to bring new ideas and new challenges. So for me, as a small farmer, obviously we have labor issues. And one of the biggest labor issues is that me and my partner, sometimes we have to leave the farm. And if we want someone to come and do our chores or do our responsibility, there's a bit of a knowledge handoff that has to happen. So in January, I built an open class Tesla install that manages all our farm chores. So at any point, I can have someone come in and the OpenClaw will walk them through how to mix the mineral feed for the pigs, right? Or the OpenClaw will help them go through all the steps. So just on a knowledge management level, it's a vision of how agents can make that kind of labor management even easier. So here's the one of the questions I wanted to ask you today, which is both self-serving, but also I think speaks to leadership and organization. You've got a choice gig running the innovation hub at FCC. How do you guys keep up? Like, we are witnessing such a rapid rate of technological change that whether it's AI or whether it's the broader technological industry, right? There's new models, there's new drones, there's new robots, there's new combines, there's new tractors. How do you practice the art of innovation when innovation is happening at such a breakneck speed that I'm assuming as an organization that has to be one of the issues you tackle with? Or am I wrong? Am I just fantasizing here?
No. I love the question. So I lead Ag Expert and the Innovation Hub at FCC. I think there's two distinct roles. With Ag Expert is Farm Credit Canada's farm management software that we've had for over 23 years. On it, we provide two tools, accounting and field. What's really interesting about that role is the use of information we have right now and how can we use that information to help the sector using historical data. And I think in terms of just using, you know, historical data, I don't think anybody else in the industry has access to it because we have activities and then we have financial outcomes and we're able to link the two together to give actual credible intelligence to the industry. So I wouldn't say that's old technology, but it's a bit of a mind shift to like focus on like on a huge problem for the industry. When it comes to innovation,
I would also give you credit there, worth highlighting, is it gives you a user base. So you actually have users, you have data, right? You have an insight into user experience that a lot of AI companies may not have. Please continue.
No, exactly. Thank you for that. That actually is like a much better answer than I had. But I was, like to that point, exactly. We have users. We have over 28,000. So that gives me like a test bed of applications where we can like test and refine different technologies. And the best technology, in my opinion, is those that you don't feel. Like you're actually seamlessly starting to use these like analytics in your operations and you don't have to like the on-ramp time to use it is super minimal. On the flip side, we have something called the Innovation Hub, and in it, there is a team called the Innovation Lab, which is basically our R&D group. I would say that's where we're testing and functioning the newer, bolder, aspirational innovations. We've come out with like a large language model called Root AI, but when it comes to like next steps, it's fascinating to see like what's the bleeding edge. And it's great because we're able to test bleeding edge technologies, but grounded in information our team also collects, which is customer sentiment information. So to answer your question, finally, the way we go about it is not to test technology for technology's sake. It always is rooted in the customer problem. Like, what is it that they're dealing with that they want solved? And what is a service that FCC can provide that isn't available today? So, again, knowledge and advisory is a huge issue in the sector because of a lot of changes that have happened over the past decade. That's what we're providing. We're providing these simple services. So, again, when we talk about the knowledge transfer between the generation going off the farm to this incoming generation, that's a huge knowledge transfer gap we need to address. When it comes to the decline of extension services, again, that's a knowledge transfer gap we need to address. When it comes to rural revitalization with the loss of jobs, like let's say legal firms or accountants, because of changing dynamics in rural communities, that's a knowledge gap too. So how can we provide that? How do we fit the technology we see today to address those questions? So that's how we try to merge the two together and try to test it as fast as possible because we should be the institution for Canadian ag where we can test and fail, because then we can share those learnings with the agricultural community.
Now, the reason I kind of highlighted the value of the user base is, you know, not just because I understand that in software terms, but I think you've emphasized the value there from knowledge terms and from knowledge transfer terms. So a kind of two-sided question. On the one hand, do you have capacity to engage them in the design process, to engage users in understanding their needs and bending the tools to their needs? And on the flip side, are there users who want that? Like, are there users who are flooding you with feature requests and, you know, kvetching about the software and pushing you to go to new places? Give me a sense of the user culture that, you know, Ag Expert and consequently the Innovation Hub are able to access.
We have a broad spectrum of, we have everybody. And it's amazing because you can see the folks who, like, will use Claude to build infrastructure for their own farms and operations. And it's amazing to see, again, to what I was talking about before, the democratizing effort. They're able to use these tools for their own benefit, and they're also able to help us push the bleeding edge. Like, can we just have an API connection and we just share data with you, and you can manage however you want the data on your farm, right? That's like one option. All the way to folks who are a little skeptical of technology. It's also a really good use case for us to test and see and refine the process so we don't make it feel as if they have to climb up a mountain to learn it. It can be a bit adaptable to their needs. So we have a broad spectrum of people, of users on the Ag Expert platform, but then even with the innovation lab that we have, again, we constantly test with users because we need to be customer obsessed, because the industry, again, God bless us, we have a big country. We have to be able to manage the different requirements and features that they're demanding of us. And we try to make their requests as seamless as possible to, like, enter our system and help build. Of course, we have to manage it appropriately, but, like, we want to make sure it's a bit of a circular, like, feedback loop, right? Because fundamentally, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what type of technology we use. It has to help them in their problem. Otherwise, it's not worth pursuing, I think. But it's still good to, you know, have a foundation to test new technology with, especially what we're seeing with, like, agentic AI right now, especially, you know, I don't know if you've read recent stories on Andon Labs, for instance, and what they were doing with agents managing a store or a vending machine. Like, that, this is where we can start testing the bleeding edge of it and see, like, what actually works. And then as a crown corporation, we're in a really ideal position because we can reduce the risk for our producers because we can share those learnings with them or create something where they can use it as a testing ground. And if they feel like they need to acquire a solution after using it, they actually have some knowledge to do that more confidently.
Well, and, you know, to your point of the Crown Corporation, where do you see open source fitting into all this? And that's, again, a double-edged question, because on the one hand, open source is driving a lot of the ecosystem right now. I mentioned OpenClaw, right? It sort of kicked off an open source AI revolution. The agentic space right now is dominated by open source projects. And a crown corporation, unlike, say, a traditional financial institution, does have kind of social enterprise tendencies, for lack of a better word, that suggests there is a bigger picture that is part of the mandate.
So I think a lot of different innovations that we've seen come out, I mean, okay, OpenClaw is one example, but when we look at other technologies, like when you look to the U.S., some of the biggest leaps that happened was because of departmental funding. Like, Silicon Valley is only there because of the DoD, because they're able to bear the brunt of that risk. So at FCC, we're able to brunt that risk. Like, again, not all the risks all the time, but, like, a good portion of it, we're able to, like, back ourselves. Like, we're able to fail fast. And that's where I think the power of a crown corporation can come in, because we reduce that risk. But also at the same time, we're the bearer of standards too. So we also want to help the market, you know, have a system where, again, if it's something simple, somebody isn't overcharging for that as well. Like, we're able to provide really great, great tools, but be the bearer of standards so that others in the market know what they need to do in order to attract users, and you know how to appropriately charge them as well. Like that's the way I see it as well. Because when we look at again innovations that have come through, the biggest, I mean, all you have to do is look to the U.S. to see like the SBIR program, the different funding tools that every department in the U.S. has to put aside just for innovative projects. Like the DoD has funded projects that are unrelated to defense, right? So it's like they're able to stimulate the economy in that way. And that I see a Crown Corporation playing in a similar space as well to help stimulate innovation too.
Right on. I may use that against you at some point in the future. One of the other questions that I like to throw at our leaders is kind of the vantage question. It's the perspective. And it goes to this hypothesis I have that part of what makes a leader is they see things others don't. And part of the privilege of being an institution is it affords you a glimpse of the sector that may be unique. And in your case, I want to frame that in the context of innovation, because on the one hand, you know, you get to see, I think, a lens of what's happening in the agricultural sector. And you asserted it at the outright by saying, rightly so, that, you know, farmers are often at the forefront of innovation and responsibly doing that. You're also at Mars, the Mars Discovery District in Toronto, right, which is one of the kind of hubs across the country. And of course, I suspect you pay attention globally, not just because of your connection to farming in Lebanon, but because you're clearly a smart and curious guy. So what do you see when you look out on the innovation landscape? You know, what catches your eye and what are the things that you think the rest of us should be paying attention to, not just on the level of trends, but on the level of kind of institutional capacity and institutional capability building? Because that's kind of what you do at FCC, right? Is to anticipate the services, the tools, the technologies that your users and the broader sector will require.
I think, you know, I love that question, and thank you for all the compliments. I love them. And, you know, honestly, great questions today. I've been really enjoying this chat. I don't want to be too abstract with the way I approach this, but I think we do a disservice to ourselves when we only focus on what are the Americans doing. And this is not to put the Americans in a corner and say that, you know, anything of the sort. It's more to say, when we miss what's happening globally, I think we miss like the chance to really leapfrog in a, like again the competitiveness of this space. Because what I think our obligation is as a Crown Corporation is to put our industry in the best position to be globally competitive. And when I see what's happening, not only in the U.S., but even, you know, down south to Brazil, when I see what's happening in Southeast Asia, outside of like the American market, and if I look at Brazil and Southeast Asia, I see some really interesting trends when it comes to how do you use your data to make your commerce faster. And when I say commerce, it's really about utilizing the data that you have on hand to increase the ability for you to, again, process whatever you need to do. Like instead of going and, you know, like to a bank waiting a few days or weeks in order to get whatever financial product you're applying for, why can't that be near instantaneous? And with the advent of, again, the different agents we're seeing today connecting the dots, how can we utilize that technology to make our, you know, our system of commerce faster? And I think this is going to have an impact, a dramatic impact in all of our lives, because if we're able to leverage technology and data, not only from what we're producing on the farm, but even different dynamic data, we're able to build that intelligence into our systems and become more adept. Again, entrepreneurs, because again, every farmer is an entrepreneur in their own right. But how can we use that information to leverage it for our own intelligence so we can make the best decisions possible? And again, it might sound a little abstract, but happy to dive deeper into it.
Well, and let me ask a relevant follow-up to that, because I think you articulated the opportunity in a really powerful way. Because on the one hand, America does dominate our perspective because they're so big, because they're so lucrative, and naturally, economically, we think about them first. But there are all sorts of global opportunities out there, right? Both on the export level and even on the import level. And it strikes me one of the obstacles is literacy and intelligence. That one of the things you could do with agents, right, with dashboards, is use that data to make that information more available to Canadian producers, more available to Canadian processors and people in the agri-food sector, so that we were able to have the nimbleness and resilience to make these, to jump on these opportunities. Am I overreading you, or is this part of what you're trying to evoke here?
No. I think that's part of what I'm trying to say. And I think, you know, with the utilization of this information and intelligence, I think, you know, there's this theme that I've heard a lot over the past couple of years where, again, this is not only specific to agriculture, but to Canada as a whole. Like, we're very risk averse, and we need to take bolder bets and bigger. Again, we have to hit, again, whatever opportunity we can get. I think one of the things that have been pushing us back is our inability to see the intelligence before we can make a play. And if we're able, again, to use these agents to connect the dots to patterns, as I mentioned at the beginning about like how I define AI, like if we're able to look at those patterns that are not discernible to the naked eye or somewhat immediately able to process and understand, that gives us such a competitive advantage globally. And that's how we can reduce our risk, but also give us the opportunity to make bolder bets as well. So I think overall, you know, what we're seeing oncoming is not only about, again, like what can an agent do? Can imagine your entire farm? Maybe potentially in the future. But I think more importantly is that intelligence that it will be able to give us at the tip of our fingers almost immediately, and how do we deploy it at a societal level as well. I think that's one of the most exciting things for me to see.
See, and now we get to take this interview and play it the way I do with an LLM, in that I love to take a context window, load it with all sorts of contradictory information, and then continue to throw queries at it to see if I can break it. So maintaining the metaphor we've just described of intelligence and opportunity and resilience and data, I think you are the first guest we've had on the podcast who's had the courage to put climate change on the table. And it's not that the other guests have avoided climate change. It's just, I think a lot of people in the sector kind of don't want to go there because it is filled with anxiety and it can be kind of contentious. But in the context of our current conversation, climate volatility provides a lot of opportunities for the sector, right? To respond to crises, to adapt to extreme weather, to anticipate drought or anticipate floods and mitigate it. And so I think where you and I have not just courage, but see opportunity in leveraging the data for that kind of responsiveness, how are you communicating that? How are you conveying that value proposition? And I'm not suggesting that the sector is against climate change. Quite the opposite. I think they're adapting quite effectively. I just don't think they're talking about it as proudly as they should, especially the innovation we could be leading on a global scale. That was a mouthful. Bail me out here, Mohammed.
Okay. Again, Jesse, what are these questions? I love this. As a sector, I think there's an look, when you look at the natural inventory report, I think the average emissions, from the ag sector is maybe 63 megatons. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it could be lower, it could be a bit higher, but around that range. I think it doesn't tell the story completely because it completely skips out on carbon sinks. When you take all of Canada together, I believe that in our soils alone, we have over 25 years of man-made emissions just captured in our soils. And that's including farmland, but then also peat in swamps and marshlands, all of Canada. That's in of itself a financial opportunity because we're storing that carbon in our soils. And even though there may be a few studies out there that have mentioned that because of our conversion of pasture land to cropland, we might have lost some of those, some megatons of carbon. Maybe. I think the story that we often overlook is the fact that when it comes to farming itself, what are the fundamentals of soil? NPK, organic C. And organic C is organic carbon. It's something that is fundamental. It's an ingredient for our soils. So again, the way we brand it, I think it has maybe not always been in the right direction or been helpful for our, again, to talk to a lot of our producers, because it's always coming from an angle of the sector is doing something wrong, as opposed to look at all the great things it's contributing to our national inventory count. How do we celebrate that? And how do we recognize producers who have done, again, who have been stewards of their land for decades and centuries potentially? And then how do we continue to encourage that behavior, right? So when it comes to climate change sustainability, I think the conversation really needs to lean towards the lens of, again, recognizing the practices that have been conducted, but then also at the same time, how do we find the opportunities through the data? And this is something that we're actively looking at Ag Expert. How do we look at that information so that if you're asking a producer to convert a practice, you're actually able to help them understand what is the downside of that change? Because changing a practice, let's say you're converting your land to cover crops, you're going to take years to potentially come back to those yields that you're previously seeing. Like you're asking somebody to lose money for a few years in order to capture more carbon. And now, while when you look at it at, again, like a high level, of course, capturing more carbon from the atmosphere is great, but how does that really help a producer be sustainable financially for their own farm and operation? So it has to go hand in hand. So I really see the information we get from our farms today as the unlock towards this next advantage that we can have as an industry too.
Well, and for two reasons. On the one hand, I think we made a terrible mistake. I think the scientists made a terrible mistake in treating climate change as an abstraction rather than grounding it in, to your point, people's operations or people's experiences. And I think similarly to your other point, that's why we need the data to demonstrate the return on more sustainable practices, because the science is there. Like the science, whether it's a gap in which, you know, the cover crop takes a little while for the fertility to come back, or it's just the change management that allows the new practices to be implemented successfully, I think there is a great opportunity to have both the data and the benchmarking to justify these different practices. But to your point, it has to be removed from shame. It has to be removed from admonishment. It has to be removed from the adversarial nature that this particular policy area has created. By all means, you can elaborate on that, but this allows me to elevate us to another card on the table, which is conspiracy and disinformation, right? Because there is no paradox to the idea that on the one hand, we've never had more information, we've never had greater tools, we've never had more access to science and the ability to do research, while we're sitting in an abundance of nonsense. And reconciling those two in a communications environment, I would not be able to ask to most ag leaders, but part of your authority, part of your leadership lies from the fact that you are a phenomenal communicator. And you've been demonstrating that throughout this episode. So again, I'm trying to break the context window by throwing every possible query I can at you. So go wherever you wish with this latest snowball of information.
I say I need you more in my life. My God, thank you.
I will take you up on that. Please continue.
So I think, like, again, it's maybe I don't want to cop out of the answer. On one hand, it's one of the foundational reasons why we have a large language model at FCC. And again, I think it's not about the tools in of its, I don't want to quote Marshall McLuhan that the medium is the message, right? But I do have to use that to an extent. Sometimes the tools you use will have an impact on the way you receive information. And I think there's, again, I'm not a communications expert in terms of like how the communication is absorbed by the general public or the general ag community. But when it comes to, like, let's say a large language model hallucinating, that's an issue, right? And we need to contend to that. And I know that's not part of what you're asking, but I'll get to that. So that's like one of the reasons. I mean, like I want to nail the head on it though. But when it comes to, like, let's say hallucinations, that's why that's inspired us to start our own large language model, because we wanted to work with different agencies to give us information so that we can create trusted and curated agricultural sources for any responses that the tool will make. So that's one hand. When it comes to the general, the misinformation that we see on a grand scale, I think it's because it's a design problem to an extent, because the way people receive information these days is so because maybe they lost a service. So I'll talk about extension services for a second. Extension services, the decline of it in terms of the ability for people to have a trusted advisor within the community. Again, I'm not saying it was a perfect system. And again, I don't have any opinion on, the way it's changed over the years. I think it's more of potentially the loss of that advisor in a community could have an impact on the way people receive trusted information. Because when you have that vacuum of trusted information, no matter what context it's in, whether it's through a person or through a tool, a digital tool, you don't have an appropriate replacement. Again, like, there's going to be a vacuum, and other tools or voices will come in and take over those voices and try to become those trusted advocates for whatever position they have. So I think that's a bit of the tension we're feeling. It's like it's a design problem to the extent as well, not only a technology problem.
Well, and let me get you to elaborate on that, because I think, to talk about, say, the role of design in Ag Expert, right, in distinguishing it as a software that serves a specific user base, but also ensuring that that software continues to serve that user base. And you could use that as kind of a case example to talk about how you see the role of design within the larger kind of innovation strategy that you get to entertain.
Yeah, and I think it's a bit of a feedback loop, right? Because, like, we test it with users, we learn, we iterate, and I think through that iteration, we're able to design a better product, because it should, again, like I've said this a few times in our chat, it's really about making sure that whatever user uses technology, they don't feel like they're using technology. Even though, again, accounting platforms are going to feel technical no matter what you do. It's an age-old problem. But how do you make it? How do you make the experience seamless for them so that they're not feeling that they're using a tool or a digital tech, like a digital interface? It's more of an experience, and I think that's one of the things that, like, we try our very best to address when it comes to other ways of sharing that information. And I will pose this as a general question. How have we been able to ensure that the information we share is actually being digested? How is it being interpreted? And I think, again, I don't know what design steps we've taken to ensure that those decisions or policy mechanisms out there have been designed to really address the needs of different communities. Again, it's not to say that they have or haven't, but it's more to say, have we? And I think if we're able to unlock the way that we can reach out to people, again, the same way we look at our technology product, I think we'll see far more success.
Well, and that's kind of matching the process with the product as an iterative innovation cycle that makes the two stronger.
Totally.
And you know, all of this kind of makes me, come back to another node that I use in my interviews with leaders. I sort of do the, what do you think of the future? And, kind of, what's your vantage point? And in your case, because we've been having this kind of sprawling conversation, I'm not going to frame it too much. I'm just going to kind of, serve it up, and you can hit it however you wish. But what do you, from a policy perspective, what catches your interest? Like, I'm going to operate on the assumption that because you pay attention to enough of the pieces within the sector and within technology, which is this whole other kind of mess, what are the policies that pique your interest? What are the policies that, you think should get more attention? Or even more so, what are the policies that you kind of got in your back pocket that you're wishing for some, fool like me to ask you to play on the table?
Oh, no, you're no fool. I would, so, you know, I generally avoid policy questions because of my status in a Crown corporation. But maybe if I could talk about, you know, what do I see at large trends that are emerging? I think we in Canada have an amazing opportunity. I think, you know, in terms of national unity, that's one thing. And I'm loving seeing that. But I think when it comes to our place on the global stage, I think this is a generational, maybe even, you know, multi-generational opportunity for us to really take a bigger swing at the world stage. And I think because of the status of our ag and agri-food sector, I think that we have had no better time than today. I mean, like, we've in FCC have launched Let's Grow Canada. I'm sure you've seen it. It's a natural effort to really celebrate ag, but I think it's like, how do we take it one step further? And it's really to look outside of Canada to see where can we, again, help fill the void when it comes to food insecurity. Like, we have a responsibility as a nation. And I don't not only say this as somebody who's Lebanese and has seen the impact of a food chain supply chain breakdown multiple times in my life, but I also see it as, you know, in the way we have, you know, adapted our system to be global in nature. What's that next step, and how can we take that next step? I think that's one of the most important questions for the industry today. There's always going to be a niche policy that some groups will want to vouch for, but I think one of the bigger opportunities right now is how can we be as entrepreneurial as possible, breaking down those doors, creating those relationships with other jurisdictions, and sometimes pressure creates opportunity. I think this is one of those moments, and leveraging all the tools at our disposal will only enable us to do this further. So, like, for instance, in Ag Expert at the moment, you know, we're building out analytical tools based on 23 years of data. How can we help other countries not only, you know, how can we share that knowledge with other countries? How can we be that world leader to be, you know, to make Canada the world's sustainable breadbasket? That's the, you know, the future I see for us. And if there's one step that I really hope that we can take as an industry, is to really look outside of our borders to see what, you know, where can we strike up those partnerships? Because again, I think we're in a really unique situation, not only as a branding exercise as a country, but also as an industry too.
So I 100% align with that. And, you know, as an aside, I would love to see more literacy around those opportunities, because I'm not sure a lot of people outside of the leadership of the sector understand the depth and the breadth of those opportunities. But I wanted to match what you just said to perhaps a naive thought, which is, when I think of the Mars Discovery District, when I think of the Vector Institute, when I think of the University of Toronto, I kind of think of this global reputation, at least we used to have, I don't know if we still have it, that we are an AI powerhouse, yeah, that we're kind of a tech powerhouse. Is there an opportunity to kind of have dance partners between tech and agriculture for, like, both of those sectors to court the global stage and be like, look at the assets that Canada uniquely has. And by the way, we're not Silicon Valley, so you can trust us. Like, do you see a play there, or am I being silly?
I know, I totally see a play, and I think that's the play we need to ensure that we get. Like, one thing I also want us is, you know, again, I'm veering into more personal territory. I don't want us to compare ourselves to other jurisdictions. When let's say, like, Silicon Valley or the North, we don't need to be. We can be our own thing, and I think being our own thing is going to make us even better. Because again, Silicon Valley has its own origin stories and it has its own you know, mission and purpose. And I think we as Canadians have our own mission and purpose as well. And I think we are much more global when it comes to the impact of the technology we built. So I don't see why we can, again, looking at Toronto, it is a reflection of the world. I believe more than 50% of Toronto's population is foreign born. Like, no other city in the world has that stat. I think that's something to celebrate, because we are that global village to an extent. I mean, I don't know what other, I don't know who could define themselves as a global village if not Toronto. So celebrating not only our diversity, but the fact that, you know, we have so many mechanisms to leverage Canadians with ties outside Canada to help help boost those exports, help boost those partnerships and connections, help boost the technology that we're building today. And I think us being more bold in our vision about, again, I love the way you framed that dance between agriculture and technology. I think we're on the cutting edge of it today, and I don't see any reason, you know, outside, and if you look at the commitments FCC has made over the past year, I think this is just a reflection of our commitment to helping the sector make that make that step.
Well, and again, I think you and I are in our jam today are striking very similar chords, because I've previously written about how the secret to Canada becoming a superpower is embracing our diasporas, embracing our networks of diasporas, our ecosystems of diasporas, because all the world comes through Toronto, Montreal, Calgary, and Vancouver. And if we could leverage those on the level of food, which is already happening, and leverage that on the level of agriculture, that's what allows us, to your point, to feed the world, to be the sustainable breadbasket. What is the, from your perspective, and this is me trying to wrap it up, where does leadership fall into that? And obviously, I've been trying to celebrate your leadership through the course of this conversation, but this is where you get to, you know, this is where I'm not trying to put it all on your shoulders, right? I'm not saying that you, Mohammed, you need to save us as a sector. No, this is where you get to push the hot potato forward. You get to help me think about the questions I asked a future guest, because I think you've done a fantastic job of framing the opportunity and incentivizing us as a sector to step up to the challenge. But I guess here's the question: what are we missing? Right. What are the pieces that our leadership, that the various elements of our sector, that maybe you take for granted, but that you're frustrated that other leaders and other organizations are not valuing in the way that again, from your vision today, you clearly see a lot of opportunities for us in the world.
First off, again, thanks for all the questions today. This has been such an amazing chat, and I think we need more of these conversations. I think we need you, Jesse. That's the missing piece, more of these conversations. Please do. This is going to sound, I want to go back to my first story and in our conversation. I think we have everything. You know, there's nothing missing for us. I think it's just, it's not about just taking that next step. I think there's sometimes, I'll talk about technology for a second here. We sometimes feel that we need to get all the puzzle pieces before we make a move, and we don't need that. You know, failing is really helpful. I had my own ag tech startup, and I often ask other founders, if they had the same strength as mine, which is pure ignorance, because if you knew all the things you needed to do as a founder, you wouldn't even start it. So I think we need to go into these initiatives a bit. Yeah, again, we just need to trust ourselves that we're going to be fine at the end of it. Because again, we have all the pieces on our side. We have the momentum, we have the support, we have the, again, having a system. Again, I think, you know, there's such a reputational, positive reputation when it comes to our own legal system. That's an amazing asset to have. I mean, like, there are many jurisdictions that don't have that, and that's why companies avoid those jurisdictions. Like, Canada has everything we need to get started, and I think sometimes we just need to be a bit more bold in the way we take those risks, because, again, I know it's hard for some folks to take some risks, but I think we have everything in our corner to make those bold bets, and sometimes all we need is a little bit of ignorance going into these things. And maybe to quote the famous country singer, I forgot her name, but, you know, let Jesus take the wheel a bit.
Right on. Well, and to your point, I always in Toronto, I used to always hear the phrase fail early, fail often. And it was not something I found easy to do in the city. But as a farmer, boy, do I get to fail early, fail often all the time, and learn from that, right? So it's phenomenal how the through line of our conversation, there's remarkable parallels between the technology sector and the agricultural sector. And if we can only get them recognizing that and dancing together, Canada's got quite the potential.
I totally agree.
So the last question segment of the show is the shout outs. And this is where we say to our guest, is there any leaders that you look up to? And this is meant to not be an Academy Award acceptance speech. This is kind of gut instinct, the names that come to mind right away. But Muhammad, who do you look up to that we should also be paying attention to?
I really, really don't mean this just because she, like, you know, the CEO of FCC is, I'm really, really trying to avoid this, like, suck up, but like, or kiss ass nature here. But it's, I think, you know, the steps that Justine has taken this, again, just seeing the way we transform as a Crown Corporation over the past 2 to 3 years has been remarkable. I think, you know, in making the bold bets, being the catalyst for change, I think recognizing that our public institutions have the ability to take those risks in order for the private sector to follow, I think is incredible, because we're putting agriculture far more on the agenda than it ever has been. And I think that's something to worth celebrating. So on one hand, if I could just have Justine, but if you want a more, a different leader I look up to, oh boy, you know, you got me there. A leader I look up to. I'm always going to, of course there's my family and everything, right? There's been so... I'd love to mention my parents for sure, just because they inspire me constantly with the resilience. And I hate using that word as Lebanese, because we've been resilient way too many times. But their ability to, you know, again, always see the positive in the world is what keeps me positive, honestly, because even though they've been through so many tragedies in their lifetime, you know, just seeing their ability to look at tomorrow as a new and better day, you know, it's just foundational for me. So, I would say my parents, both of them.
Right on. Great selections. And thanks again, Muhammad. This has been a tour de force. And this is always the point at the end of the episode where I say, we got to have you back, only because we've only scratched the surface. And because I am conspiring to put together a panel on AI and agriculture as a future episode, because there's so much to get into in terms of the possibilities and the opportunities. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Jesse, and I can't wait for the next Nerd Gem to come around the corner. It'll be fun to participate.
Right on. And of course, the thing about a good Nerd Jam is it's inherently inclusive. It's not meant to alienate. It's not meant to make you feel dumb. Quite the opposite. We want you to feel smart. We want you to lean in and go, open claw? What was Jesse talking about when he mentioned open claw? And what do they mean by agents? What are these agents that everyone's talking about? I don't know how familiar you are with this lingo. Part of what we're trying to achieve here with the podcast is kind of prime your brain so that you start hearing these words here. Then you start seeing these words elsewhere and they start to become legible. They start to make sense. Again, this is partly how we're trying to insert AI into the larger threads and conversations we're having here on the Future Herd. We are, of course, focused on the future of the agri-food sector. And the thing about artificial intelligence is, on the one hand, a lot of people are deathly afraid of it. And on the other, people kind of are just integrating it into their systems, into their lives, and they're not really thinking or talking or philosophizing. And so that's why I really loved talking with Muhammad, because it allowed us to not only get into the blue sky, big picture stuff that I love so much, but he brought us into the details, into the practical, into the applied aspects of
agriculture and agri-food that I think really speaks to innovation on the front lines. And if anything, that may be one of the themes that we come back to, which is how do we get these tools in the hands of farmers? How do we ensure that it helps increase their yields, their productivity, keeps their animals safer, healthier, more productive? These may be abstract concepts to those of you who are just learning about AI, but, you know, quite frankly, those of us who are as excited at this moment by the power of this technology, you know, we're kind of becoming almost evangelical, a little popular education when it comes to helping people understand the risks, but also the reward. So thanks again. This has been another fantastic episode. You can check us out at thefutureher.ca. Of course, there's commons.thefutureher.ca, which is our interactive aspect of our website. And we got some special episodes coming up, including our first panel. So we'll catch you again real soon.